Good evening, everybody, and welcome, a very warm welcome to LSE for this evening's event. My name is Mary Martin. I'm a senior research fellow at LSE Ideas and the Department of International Relations at LSE, and it's a great honour for me to welcome four experts, expert speakers on our topic tonight. On my left, I'm sure many of you are aware, Dr. John Collins is Executive Director of the International Drug Policy Project here at LSE Ideas. On my right, Professor Lawrence Phillips is Emeritus Professor of Decision Sciences in the Department of Management at LSE. And on my immediate left, I'm also delighted to welcome to the LSE Dr. Joanne Chetta, who teaches at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health and is a commissioner of the Lancet Commission on Drug Policy. And on my far right, Dr. Michael Shiner, who is head of teaching for the Drug Policy Project, associate professor in the Department of Social Policy at LSE. This event, entitled Drug Policies Beyond the War on Drugs, marks the fifth lecture in the 2017 series of LSE Works. LSE Works is a series of public lectures that began in 2011, which aim to showcase some of the latest research by LSE academic departments and research centres in an accessible manner. In each session, LSE academics present key research findings, demonstrating, where appropriate, the implications of their studies for public policy. Held every 2 years, a successful second series of LSE Works was held in 2013, continued with a third series in 2015. And this year, 2017, LSE is delighted to continue the success of LSE Works with a fourth series of public lectures. And just to give you a heads up, the next LSE Works lecture will be given by Professor Attar Hussein from LSE's Institute of Global Affairs and Professor Stefan Feuchtwang from the Department of Anthropology, and it will be called Urbanization in China, Patterns and Governance. And that will be held on Wednesday, the 22nd of February, so next week at 6:30, here, also here in the Hong Kong Theatre. So for tonight's event, though, as countries examine new ways of managing drug issues beyond the problematic and simplistic model of the war on drugs, in this lecture tonight we'll begin with Dr. John Collins and followed by Professor Lawrence Phillips examining how LSE research, among others, can help impact and drive government policies. They'll draw on a number of LSE Ideas reports and they'll examine new methods for evaluating and managing global drug issues. I'll then ask Dr. Chetta to talk about public health and drug policy reform, and finally Dr. Shiner will talk to us about legalization of cannabis in the UK. So a really varied, four for the price of one, a varied menu, and very much looking forward to hearing what they have to say. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSEWorks. Please, if you haven't already done so, put your phones on silent so we don't get ringing going off. The event is being recorded and hopefully will be made available as a podcast, but as ever, subject to any technical difficulties. After each of the speakers have presented their ideas, their research, there'll be a chance for you to put questions to them. But for now, will you please join me in welcoming Dr. John Collins and Professor Lawrence Phillips to deliver their lecture entitled Drug Policies Beyond the War on Drugs. Let me start with John. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mary. Before I begin, I want to say two quick thank yous. One is to our director of LSE Ideas, Professor Michael Cox. He sadly couldn't be here tonight, but it was his idea that we do this lecture in LSE Works, and it is a great forum for us to showcase the work that we've been doing at Ideas in Drug Policy over the last... The project is about 5 or 6 years old now, so we've been engaging this for a very long time, and it's a pleasure to be able to present our work. I also want to thank my team at Ideas, because we've just come out of a major international conference the last 2 days, and we went straight into doing this event, so we literally haven't had a time to stop. But Alex and Frederick and Jimmy and Adriana and Joe, we really appreciate all the work that they do at LSE Ideas, so it's and I'm delighted to see them here tonight as well. All right, so my focus is really going to be very broad and quite international, and it's I'm going to stick to really big picture discussions of this topic. Trying to outline where I'm aiming for two strands here. The first one is trying to outline and give a sense of where drug policy discussions are kind of progressing internationally. And alongside that, I'm going to give a few examples of how LSE research is fitting into those discussions and helping drive those discussions. Because I work at LSE Ideas, we're a think tank. Our aim is to impact government policy. We judge ourselves on how well we are getting our research into government discussions and actually driving policy forms or discussions forward. So before I begin, I always like to do this because it just gives me a temperature of the audience, but very quickly, hands up here who thinks that the war on drugs has been a success. Right, I don't see, sometimes I see hands, I don't see any hands today. Hands up who thinks it's been a failure. Okay, so pretty uniform. Hands up who's not sure. Okay, so a couple of hands, that's reasonably in line with what normally. All right, so frankly, that's reflective of the pretty overwhelming policy consensus among, I think, progressives, at least at the international level, that the war on drugs is a discredited strategy. We're no longer quite arguing over whether the war on drugs is a discredited strategy. It's more a question now of how we move beyond it. A lot of states that were previously very heavy proselytizers of the idea of the war on drugs, Joanne would highlight the United States being key among them, would now go to international forums and say, we don't fight a war on drugs. We don't believe in that strategy. That's not what we're about, regardless of what policies they're actually seeking to implement. But this slide gives a sense of some of the groups that have come out against the idea overtly over the last few years. You know, you've got current and former presidents throughout Latin America and North America. You've got the Global Commission on Drugs. You've got the Lancet Commission on Drugs. You've got the LSE Expert Group on the Economics of Drug Policy. You've got Nobel Prize winners. All of these groups over the last few years have come out and effectively rubbished the idea that a war on drugs is the way to address this issue. Now, the question is there international appetite at the international level to continue this strategy? I think we'll see. I don't think we're going to see the kind of uniform strategy we've seen over the last 3, 4, 5, 6 decades. I think there's a serious fracturing going on at the international level. Some will continue it, clearly. The Philippines is the most recent example of that. Some governments are extremely enthusiastic about this idea of really tackling the social ill through a hardline response. But if we look at the most recent UN meeting on this topic, the UN General Assembly Special Session on Drugs in 2016, although many would highlight that it was a failure on many reformist fronts, you know, you didn't get a condemnation of the death penalty in there. You didn't get a condemnation of extrajudicial killing in the name of drug control. You didn't get a specific mention of the successes of harm reduction in managing some of the demand side issues. So in that way, it was a failure for many involved. But what it did in the process of UNGAS, in the years leading up to it, which LSE was a participant of that process, and many of the people on this table were a participant of that process, it changed the narrative at the international level, I think, sufficiently, and it changed the trajectory of discussions at the international level, I think, sufficiently, that in that process we could see the birth of what we could call the post-war on drugs era. And I do think we are embarking on that era. I don't think we're going to go back to the uniform pursuit of a war on drugs because the political will isn't there in a lot of contexts. Even if Jeff Sessions or Donald Trump decide that the war on drugs is a good way to distract attention back home, they're not going to be able to rally domestic constituencies behind it, in my view. So that's why we get to this question of not if, but how. That's why this lecture is entitled Beyond the War on Drugs or After the War on Drugs. It's basically highlighting that we're not actually spending our time discrediting this strategy. We're trying to think of next steps. To give a very quick overview of our publications at Ideas and also to give a sense of how quickly this debate has shifted. In 2012, we produced a report. It was called Governing the Global Drug Wars. President Juan Manuel Santos of Colombia actually wrote the foreword to the report back in 2012. And this is what he said. Our invitation is to dutifully study new formulas and approaches screened through an academic, scientific, and non-politicized lens because this war has proven to be extremely challenging and oftentimes highly frustrating. That was new in 2012. The idea of a head of state openly challenging whether the war on drugs was a good strategy to manage this issue was completely new back in 2012. And it really gives a sense of how quickly this shifted. And the language was quite careful, but it was also quite radical for the time in what he said. And that's when you see that debate really starting to emerge at the international level, where certain leaders felt comfortable criticizing it. President Obama was, as well, actually quite openly critical of the war on drugs, and he became more so throughout his presidency. So following that, we established the expert group on the economics of drug policy, and in 2014 we released a report called Ending the Drug Wars. And it was endorsed by 5 Nobel Prize-winning economists. It got enormous press attention. We had 1,000 press hits the day after it was released. It was on all sorts of international media. It was huge. It was the biggest thing we've done in the Drugs Project while we've been at Ideas in terms of press impact. And that's what it said. It's time to end the war on drugs and massively redirect resources towards effective, evidence-based policies underpinned by rigorous academic analysis. You know, we're at an academic institution. How could you argue with that framing, that policy should be based on evidence and a rigorous analysis, and that we should move beyond a simplistic war model? That made news in 2014. That made international news. That's how new this discussion was, that was seen as newsworthy. Now, when we got beyond that, the idea of criticizing the war on drugs became, it was like shooting fish in a barrel, right? Everybody was seemingly after 2013, 2014, coming out and saying the war on drugs has failed, we need new approaches. And it was hard to get, press became less interested. When you talk to them about this topic, they'd say, well, of course, we all know that the war on drugs is a failed strategy. So within 2 or 3 years, you saw this massive normative shift, where when you talk to people, regardless of what policy, the policies didn't change that much, but the normative aspect, the rhetoric around it, changed rapidly in 2 or 3 years. So when we produced our next report of the expert group in 2016, we knew that it wasn't going to be just war on drugs bashing. It had to be a sense of, right, what comes next? And what we really said, our key insight after the Drug Wars report, was that you replace the kind of prohibitionist policies of the war on drugs with the SDGs. That the SDGs is a useful, cohering and convening mechanism to simply deprioritize ineffectual war on drugs policies and put in a new framework which is based on health, human rights, sustainable development, those key goals. And the report was actually endorsed by 6 Nobels, 4 economists, 1 in biology, and President Santos as well, who was later named a Nobel. So now to shift quickly, this is just to give a sense of one of the frontiers that we're working on and interested in, and this is, Joanne is going to go into this in much greater depth. But in terms of the public health side, what we see is a much greater consensus, I think, and that's relative, a relatively greater consensus about what we should be doing. That we know, actually, we have a lot of experience about what works in drug policy and what doesn't work on the demand side. Repressive, highly criminalized, policing-based policies just quite simply do not work. Not only do they not work, they produce more harm than good in many, many cases. And so what we know is that policies based on principles of reducing the harms of consumption, harm reduction, providing social services and wraparound social services for people with drug dependence issues, providing access to social services, so not putting up barriers to the treatment services that they require, those are the ways to manage those issues. So when we look at this as LSE Ideas, we're thinking, where are the frontiers of this, right? How can we, when we go into a specific national context, how can we push that forward? Because we actually know what we should be doing. It's just very hard to muster political will in some cases. And it is very contextual. So we think of an advanced consumer country, let's say Ireland, let's say the UK, France, anywhere in Europe. The issue is about embedding and improving policies beyond criminalization, right? It's about effectively expanding people's access to public health services, as I said, and also getting beyond the criminalization paradigm. That in advanced consumer countries, criminalization generally does more harm than good, and we need to find a framework for countries to move beyond it. And I'll highlight Ireland in a moment. In developing countries, it is a very different context, right? You're talking about places with very low social service provision to begin with in a lot of cases. And so actually, when the state doesn't have much capacity to act positively, we're merely trying to prevent it acting negatively. Because criminalizing vast swathes of the population, making them engage in more dangerous drug-taking activity, all these sorts of things, is actually what drives a lot of the harm. And then the final point on this would be that we can do this and we can say this point. We can say about decriminalization because there has been a lot of research on this topic, and I think it's approaching an exhaustive stage, and I think Dr. Shiner could talk more on this, but it is that we've found no correlation between criminalization and consumption. Countries with more repressive policies do not have, by and large, less consumption. Countries with less repressive policies, by and large, do not have more consumption. And so we recognize at an academic level that the probabilities is we should move towards decriminalization. So this is one of our most successful interventions or initiatives, I think. It was supported by the LSE Knowledge Exchange and Impact Fund, who continued to support our work in Ireland. But we basically, Ireland took a major step forward when a progressive drugs minister took office. And around 2014, 2015, you saw a rapid shift in the debate. That he was saying, I want a new approach. I think this war model has failed. I feel this stigmatization of people who have difficult lives already is not an effective way to do this. And we held a seminar in November 2015, and the minister actually came and announced that he was going to open a safe injection site in Ireland. So a facility where people, you're not provided the substances, but you can inject under supervised conditions, which means people aren't injecting in alleyways, they're not potentially overdosing, they're not sharing syringes, things like that. And so that's actually progressing. He announced that, and that made international news. That was front page of Irish News, that he announced this at the London School of Economics. And not only that he announced that he wanted to see decriminalisation as the policy trend in Ireland. And those discussions are ongoing, and that's something that three of us actually were in Dublin a couple of weeks ago at a conference trying to discuss this and find ways to move that forward. Now, if we switch quickly to the supply side, this is more of a case where we don't have a huge amount that we can prescribe, that we can say, well, we know exactly what to do when it comes to minimizing the harms of the market. But it's similar to what I was saying about a developing country situation. A lot of what we do is actively harmful and totally ineffective. So we have a huge amount of evidence now on what the efficacy of policing is, or the marginal efficacy of policing. And what Peter Reuter and Harold Pollack call the classical assumption of the war on drugs has been demonstrated to be wrong. The idea that more policing leads to higher prices of these substances and therefore must lead to lower consumption. That is the classical idea of the war on drugs. That's why we do more. That's why we hire more police. That's why we kick in more doors. That Reuter and Pollack in 2014 went and looked at every shred of evidence that was available on the marginal efficacy of policing, and they said there's not a shred of evidence. Actually, we have no evidence that increasing resources to policing increases price. Therefore, we have no evidence it's reducing consumption. And so what that effectively says is the majority of what we're doing in drug policy, policing, supply-side enforcement, has zero marginal efficacy based on the evidence. If we look at how that applies to producer countries, we already had economic models and empirical evidence to confirm this fact. If you talk to economists, you know, why is it impossible to eradicate black markets? Because there's a price incentive for people to supply. The tougher you push down, the more people have an incentive to supply. So the most you can do through enforcement, you can't decrease aggregate supply. We've lots of evidence on that front. You can displace it. You know, you push drugs out of one community, they'd pop up in another. You push coca production down in Colombia, it pops up in Peru or Bolivia. And we have lots of evidence about that at the international level. Alongside that is a political economy effect, which is well demonstrated by Mexico. You know, your job as a police agency is to get scores on the board, to get seizures, to make arrests, regardless of what that does to the political economy of the trade. Well, Mexico had a view that we would take out, they had a decapitation strategy, which is we take out the top levels of the cartels should collapse. What actually happened? The mid-levels of the cartel went to war with each other to take over the top levels of the cartel. Then the cartels went to war with each other to take over territory. Then they went to war with the state to take over territory. So in the process of this supply-side policy, you see an exponential rise in violence. That is not dependent on the drug market itself. Drug markets are illicit and thereby there's criminal activity, but they are not necessarily as violent as they are. And what we're seeing is that policy is often making them more violent. Right, so this is to highlight, I think, some of the political economy now. So I've talked about some of the demand side issues, some of the economics of the supply side issue. This is to highlight the political economy we face when we go to rural areas in places like Colombia. This is in Putumayo in Colombia in 2015. And to just give a sense of how remote that is, this was a two-hour flight from Bogota, a two-hour drive on a dirt road, which is kind to call it a dirt road. It was just basically stones cobbled together, to the end of that dirt road. Then it was a two-hour boat ride upriver. This is how hundreds of thousands of people in Colombia, this is the level of remoteness of these areas when we talk about coca-producing areas. There is no market access, there is no roads, there is no state security or social service provision. So the idea of them growing alternative crops in the immediate term is nonsense. It's not possible. You can't get these crops to market. It's too expensive. So this is the response that we get to that economic reality. This was a field that I was told, I can't confirm it, that was sprayed by glyphosate prior. Now, glyphosate, there's a moratorium on it in Colombia at the moment. But hundreds of thousands of hectares of Colombian rainforest have been sprayed by glyphosate in an attempt to eradicate coca. There is a huge amount of academic evidence on this produced by people like Daniel Mejia in Colombia and Hernando Zuleta and others looking at the efficacy of aerial spraying. And what they find is it's extraordinarily expensive, it's extraordinarily ineffective, it destroys the local environment, it poisons the water supply, and it's a carcinogen. And yet we do it anyway, or yet governments do it anyway, and Colombia, it is still an open debate of whether they will return to doing this. This is what glyphosate did to one of the coca plants. Not very much. As I said, it's not very effective. It destroys all of the plants in the surrounding areas, and as a biologist who looked at these photos said, they've probably actually made it more effective for coca to grow in those areas because they're removing the competition. And then just to wrap up, to just give a sense of the direction and the political will on this. This was a few months later, we were back in Colombia. Professor Cox was presenting our report to President Santos. In the front row there, you can't see it, but the entire government was actually lined up there, barring one or two ministers who were away at the time. And he basically stood up and said, you know, this is equivalent to cycling a stationary bike. We have been doing this for four decades in Colombia, and it hasn't worked. And so you do see that there is a political recognition and a political will on this topic. It's just a sense of what's next. So this is what we're doing. This is one of our initiatives. And as I was saying, we're just finished. This actually happened Monday and Tuesday this week. We have an innovation lab which we're running with a German development funder, or German development implementer, GIZ. And it's about bringing countries together and trying to share international experiences, trying to engage. So it's not just academics, it's not just policy people, but it's also, we had government representatives from Switzerland, Norway, Mexico, Colombia, Thailand. So it's about getting people around a table and trying to mesh, to break down the silos, to use an academic cliche, between policy making, academia, and actual policy research. So I'll conclude by just putting these up. These are the four recommendations plus sub-recommendations of the LSE expert group. And I think they're reasonably straightforward, but if this is the framework that we at IDEAS and the team at the Drug Policy Project operate on, and this is our way of trying to progress on this topic, and a lot of them I've already said, the SDGs and the public health approach, and in trying to find a more harm reductionist approach to supply side, and then ultimately this idea of policy experimentation. We're going to learn an awful lot what happens when the US legalizes cannabis, when Canada probably almost certainly legalizes cannabis, when Uruguay moves ahead with its legalization, when other states in Europe which have de facto legalized progress with that. When we shift from a massive illicit market to illicit one, we're going to learn a lot. And this is a field that, as I said, hasn't had much policy experimentation in the last few decades, and that's why we're relatively encouraging. It's not saying that we have the answer or that there's a rapid shift that the entire world should go, but the emergence of policy experimentation on this, I think, is a heartening thing. So I will leave it there, but thank you very much for listening.
John, thank you very much for an excellent introduction and setting the tone. And I can ask Professor Summers now, who's going to take us more perhaps into that policy experimentation or policy mechanics with your research. Over to you.
Good. Thanks very much. I think John invited me here because he knows that I know how to turn evidence into policy recommendations. And that's an important step, but it's far from being a silver bullet to solving the world problem. But it's a step, and it's a piece. And I should remind you that my wife, over many times in over the years, has reminded me that I have a touching faith in rationality. Okay, I want to talk first, starting from the evidence. I helped David Nutt and Les King and the whole Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs to look at 20 psychoactive drugs and apply multi-criteria decision analysis, which I'll explain in a minute, to evaluate the relative harm of these drugs. And that was published in The Lancet, so it's easy for you to get and to read the methodology. But it's that particular methodology which arises out of the field of decision analysis that has bridged the gap. In fact, as I was coming down here, I realized the last time I was on this platform was several years ago when the Department of Management, that was 10 years ago, first started. And this was the first public lecture that I gave about how to use this methodology to help and form recommendations by the Committee on Radioactive Waste Management about what the UK government should do with its high-level and medium-level radioactive waste. So this methodology applies to anything where you've got options and lots of different criteria, and no option is good on everything. So what is multi-criteria decision analysis? Well, in the upper left-hand corner, that's Ralph Keeney, who was then the student of Howard Rafa at the bottom, and it's that book that they wrote back in 1976 called Decisions with Multiple Objectives, which is a methodology for appraising options on multiple criteria and then combining them into one overall appraisal. And it does this by converting all the input data of whatever kind it is into a common unit of value added. And I don't mean by that financial value, although that could be one of the criteria. I was driving with my family at one point in Colorado, and I just want to make sure that you understand this is not something about multi-criteria decision analysis. It's useful to contrast it with what it isn't. This is actually a real sign just outside Gold Hill, which was a former mining town in Colorado. And the sign up there, part of which I've covered up, says, established in 1859, elevation 8,463 feet, population 118. I had to jump out of my car and take that picture. MCDA does not compare apples with oranges, as some people think. What it compares is the added value of apples and oranges for achieving your objectives. And if it's to make apple crumble, well, I don't know about you, but I don't put oranges in apple crumble. So it has no value for that purpose. So MCDA is very goal-oriented. As you'll see, because here's the study design for the drug harms research. We represent this as a value tree, and what we really want to do is to get a sense of the overall harm of 20 drugs relative to one another. And you'll see that that's divided into the harm to others and the harm to users, others, users. And then both users and others are divided up into physical harm, psychological harm, and social harm. And then we have further created some criteria at the very end, the right-hand end of the value tree. So we are, and that took, by the way, a day and a half to develop with the Advisory Council of Misuse on Drugs, which is an advisory group on the misuse of drugs to the Home Office. So that was really hard work because there were, all the ISCD members who then filled this all in and used it, but it was the ACMD that originally developed this. And they came up with 16 harm criteria, and that's 16 at the very end here. Now, we facilitated this meeting also as a decision conference. I only work now with groups because it doesn't matter what the topic is, experts always disagree. And it's not just because they're bloody-minded, it's because they have different perspectives on the issues. They come from it at different angles. They have different experience. And what I want to do is get a dialogue going in this group so that the dialectic makes clear where some people go in one direction, others go in other, and all those criteria at the end of that tree represent the differences of viewpoints of the members in the ACMD. So here's a 1 to 3 day workshop to resolve issues of the important issues, always attended by key players with this diversity of perspective, and I facilitated them because I've been trained in group processes as well as decision analysis. And we try to create a good enough model that will at least resolve the issues at hand. It isn't intended to give the right answer, because there isn't one. There are as many answers as there are perspectives. Okay, here are the 20 drugs. You can have a look. See if you find your favorite recreational drug there. Most are illegal. Some aren't. And now I want to give you the results. When we applied MCDA, and I'll show you a little bit more about what it is, when we applied the MCDA, we were able to come up with one overall figure for each of the 20 drugs. And here it was. So, the y-axis is harm. The more harm to users, that's the blue bit. The red bit is harm to others. And the most harmful drug was clearly alcohol. Largely because of the big red bit. It's very harmful to others, and in particular, it's harmful to costs. Something like, there's an estimate that for all of us UK taxpayers, £1,000 for every taxpayer in this country each year goes to the consequences of drug abuse. Alcohol abuse, I mean. Alcohol abuse. Just alcohol. So that's pretty serious. So we also did this on a scale that's a ratio scale. Not a cardinal scale, a ratio scale. Zero meant no harm. The biggest harm was whatever it was on that criterion. So you can compare the ratios of those numbers. And alcohol, for example, is 3 times as harmful overall as cocaine, is one conclusion. Okay, so that's the research. Now, a few years later, we suddenly thought, well, all this is options and criteria. The options could be policy options. That was my experience with the Committee on Radioactive Waste Management, and that's why David Nutt quotes that in his book, because he figured, if you could do it for that, maybe you could do it for drug harm policy. And to our good luck, a man named Ole Rogaberg in Norwegian got a grant to do this and asked us if we would do it for him. So the purpose was to develop a framework for describing, measuring, assessing, and discussing drug policy. And we ran 2 decision conferences, one in September 2015 and one in January 2016. There were 18 participants in each of those, the same participants, from a great variety of backgrounds. David Nutt and I facilitated, and we managed to develop 3 models, one for alcohol, one for cannabis, and one for heroin. And I'd now like to show you those results. But before I do that, let me show you what the policy options were. Now, you'll notice along the top are the various things that we thought you would need to address if you're going to create a policy. How are they produced? Sale and distribution, purchase volume, possession, use. Now, you could I'm not suggesting this is the right model. This is the starting point for doing a better one. And under each of those, we had a long list of possibilities, which we collectively collapsed into a combination that's red, which is basically an absolute prohibition, and down at the bottom is green, and that's decriminalization. The yellow one is a state control. Free market is along the bottom. I'm sorry, it's misaligned up at the top. Free market is the green one at the bottom. Then the yellow one is decriminalization. Yeah, and the orange one is state control, and the red one is absolute prohibition. So there are 4 policy options made up of some combinations. If you were to improve on policies, after you see this result, you might go back and fiddle them around, and you might fiddle differently for the different drugs as well. We started with the harms in the ACMD model, but we extended it so that it was now 27 evaluation criteria, and the nodes there, which you can't really read because everything's too small, the very top node is 5 health impacts, and the next ones are social impacts, political, public, crime, economic, costs, and so forth. Okay? So I think everybody should be clear that there are 27 things you could argue about, in case you hadn't noticed, by the way, that debt policy is very difficult to get agreement about. Yeah, 27 things. Here's what we do in multi-criteria decision analysis. In this case, we created a cardinal scale where on a particular criterion, this one is the criterion criminalizes users, you can see that zero was assigned to absolute prohibition because that's the least preferred option. And the one that's most preferred would be the free market, because if it's a free market, you can't criminalize them. So that's the best thing that could happen. Whereas state control is a little bit down from that, and then decriminalization is sort of halfway in between. Now, those were judgments that were made by these people. Obviously, we have to make judgments because there are no data about these things, or when there are data, they are brought into the discussion. Now, we call this scoring the policy options, and it's a cardinal scale or an integral scale, so that differences between scores are interpretable, or the ratios of the differences are interpretable. Now, you always have to take, here's that same criterion. Some criteria represent more harm reduction than others. In other words, going from the bottom to the top is bigger, and sometimes it's smaller. So we do a process called swing weighting, which asks the question, how big is the difference in harm reduction from the least harm to the most harm, and how much do you care about that for that particular criterion? So you're essentially looking at that difference. And again, all the people in the room participated in this. So we've got two sets of numbers, scores and swing weights. You multiply the scores by the swing weights, and now everything is a common unit, and you can just add things together to get the results. I do want to say one thing here, though. Four policies are all hypothetical states about the future, and we don't have any data about the future. So how reliable or repeatable and valid, that is representing actual harm reduction, are direct preference judgments? Well, in 2013, David Nutt said to me, let's repeat the UK drug harm study, but let's do it for Europe. I said, won't work, too many differences from one country to the next. Well, I sort of think it will, he said. So he twisted my arm and we did it. We went to Brussels. We had 30 people in the room, only two of whom were from the original UK, and they didn't say very much because they only contributed to a couple of criteria. So I got weighted scores for the whole of Europe. And then I can still remember the night I was sitting in my room correlating those scores with the UK drug harm scores, because everything is the result of group discussion and judgment. And there was the correlation. The scatter plot and the correlation coefficient is 0.993. My training originally was an engineer, but later, as an experimental psychologist, we never get correlations like that. So I had to look very carefully through about this and think about it a lot to figure out how could there be such a good correlation. And I think the answer is that there's a huge amount of information in clear definitions of the criteria. That's the key. And the group members represent different perspectives, so that everything that somebody might argue has been part of the dialectic. And then they're peer-reviewing each other on the spot. And the group has to be facilitated. I want to make sure that everybody is actually engaged. And now, here you are, finally the results. MCDA results for alcohol on the left, for cannabis on the right. Okay? The leftmost bar is free market. The tallest one for both, state control. Next, decriminalization. And then absolute prohibition. We also did, and we've just submitted that for publication. But we also did it for heroin, and we're going to have to write a different paper about that, because here's the result. There's heroin compared to alcohol. Back and forth, you can see. State control again. All the slices, the colored slices, are those nodes: health impact, social impact, political impact. And we said, maybe we've got the weights wrong on those nodes. So we did sensitivity analyses on them. There's a sensitivity analysis. Now, this is the cannabis model. And what that says along the x-axis is, well, how much weight did you put on that node, that health impact node? And where the vertical line exists, that's the weight. It's about not quite 25%. And it intersects option two, which is state control. And no matter where it is, you know, even if you moved it, that vertical red line, state control would win. And here it is for everything else. Here, this is for the other nodes. Now, there's a crossover there. But my goodness, that one's impact on crime. You have to put that way out until you've virtually got a free market. Well, nobody's going to do a free market in cannabis, I'm sure, and so forth. So basically what we're saying is, really, it doesn't matter what weights you put on these things. It's still cannabis comes heavily on state control. And I should say the same thing is true of alcohol and heroin. So it's a robust conclusion. Well, so what does that mean? Well, the alcohol results confirm that what we're doing now, current public health and medical opinion, but that's not so for cannabis and heroin. In fact, you know that David Nutt's complaint on the ACMD when he was the chair, and they reclassified it as an even more dangerous drug, he got fired for that. For both substances, a legal but strictly regulated market is judged to yield the best reduction. Well, we had to ask ourselves, was there a reformist bias in our group? It's entirely possible. Yeah. But that's why we need some further research by other teams with other perspectives. It would be fun to get some politicians in on this. But at least my point is that we now have a framework for translating evidence, as far as you've got it, into policy recommendations. And that was the purpose of this. If you want to read more about it, there's David Nutt's book, which is actually very good. And if you want to read about decisions with multiple objectives, that's the... But if you want to read chapter 6 in the one on the left, you can download it for free. It's on the LSE. Just Google the title and it comes up. And it's chapter 6, explains MCDA in a fairly simple way. Okay? That's it.
Thank you very much, Professor Phillips. I think that was a brilliant example of how primary research, methods analysis, which of course originates in the academy, can inform policy decisions, policy making, particularly if, as John said at the outset, we're at a kind of new moment of policy experimentation when it needs to be denser, more complex, more nuanced, and you've given us a good idea of a framework to do that. Dr. Chetter, can I ask you to... You've got the...
Yeah, there should be some slides. Good evening, everyone. Being outside
the... You have to push the button on gadget there.
Thank you.
Next one?
Yep. Being outside the U.S. for a few days feels a little bit like getting a temporary release from an asylum run by a hyperventilating, braying huckster. And if only that were actually a metaphorical description. I have been interested to see in the UK press the preoccupation with the prospective visit to the UK of President Voldemort. And even if he is, even if they sneak him in through the Cotswolds or whatever they're going to do to make everyone less nervous, I'm really hoping that our British brothers and sisters will find a way to give him the very warm and energetic welcome that he deserves. So we'll count on you for that, and thank you in advance for your solidarity. And for those of you who were on the street on January 21st, thank you very much. I work in a public health faculty, and I think I'm constantly inspired by our great students at Columbia and my faculty colleagues, because so many of them have come to our profession because, if this doesn't sound too presumptuous, it's of its sort of inherent nobility, its focus on serving marginalized people in society and its focus on addressing inequality. But with respect to the direction of drug policy, as John was beginning to lay it out, it would certainly be great to have drug policy that is framed around a public health conceptual framework. That would be the center of our thinking. What I'd like to bring to you tonight is a little bit my fear that we have entered a moment in the drug policy debate in some countries and certainly in the international arena, where I'm afraid that public health rhetoric, maybe public health practice to some degree, are being ill-used as a smokescreen to hide repressive policies. And mostly what I'd like for us to think about tonight is, when a country says it has a health-based approach to drugs, what does that really mean? What should it mean? It's not as though it hasn't happened before. Ooh, there's a thing here, yeah. That public health has been used to mask repressive or generally unsavory policies. The U.S., for example, for many years, beginning in the 1960s, supported so-called population control activities that were dressed up as a public health assistance or as a peace and security measure or in neo-Malthusian terms as an ecological measure. But we know from the excellent work of historians and from our own good sense that a lot of these programs were motivated by a racist project in that they would address the problem of too many non-white people in the world. The U.S., by law, for some years, tied its economic and development assistance to countries' ability to prove that they were controlling their populations, which led in some well-documented cases to forced sterilization and other coercive measures. When it comes to drug policy, the way that this commitment to a health-based approach has often been framed is with this catchy phrase, patients, not criminals. Patients, not criminals. That is to say, and this came out very clearly in the debates in the General Assembly special session on drugs that some of you may have followed last April, that countries said over and over again that drug use itself, consumption itself, was something that they would commit themselves to treat as a public health issue, treat it in the public health sector and not in the criminal justice sector, patients, not criminals. It was striking to me how easily this phrase dropped from the mouths of delegates from countries with very, very repressive policies. So the question is this a step forward, a change of heart on the part of countries whose prisons are filled with minor drug offenders who will now be seen as candidates for health services, or is this something else? The formulation itself, patients not criminals, merits some scrutiny. Parenthetically, first of all, it seems to suggest that everybody who is now classified as a criminal by repressive laws should be a patient, that is, is an addict and deserves some sort of treatment, but that's not true. By the UN's own conservative estimate of people who use drugs, even quite regularly, it's only about 10 or 12% who ever have what we would call problematic drug use or become dependent, so patients is not a useful characterization. But moreover, for many of those who are even legitimately deemed to be drug dependent, the supposed health services that are offered to these patients are frequently not scientifically sound, in the worst cases, much worse than prison, and indeed may be well characterized as forms of torture. This is not what drug treatment, addiction treatment, should look like. Throughout Asia, we see compulsory drug detention centers that look like this. This one is in China. Many of these countries say that they want to treat drug users as patients, not criminals. This is not, as in the detoxification camp in Laos, what treatment should look like. This is not what treatment should look like. This is what forced labor looks like. And this is what really cheap labor that has an economic importance and therefore some political clout looks like in this case in China, but these places are all over the world, really. And we just can't get into a lot of them to get pictures. I really give credit to Human Rights Watch, which has done a lot of work on, in Southeast Asia in particular, to get into these places. Often these places are run by the military, and I don't mean the health people within the military, I mean the military. And in Thailand, for instance, it was found by great research by our good colleagues at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver that people who were released from these compulsory detention treatment centers were reluctant to seek health care in the community, at least partly because part of the treatment was to make them so ashamed of being drug users that they didn't want to reveal that in the health system. Treatment shouldn't look like this either. This is a picture taken at the Jesus Divine Temple Prayer Camp in Ghana, but Ghana is far from alone in having addiction treatment sectors that are dominated by faith-based groups that are not regulated or monitored in any way. For what other sort of health problem affecting millions of people in the world would anyone call chaining them to a tree and beating them to a pulp a form of treatment? Well, in line with its outsized role in every other aspect of ill-conceived drug policy, the United States is at the head of the queue in saying that it has a public health approach to drug and wants to treat drug use as a matter of health, not as a matter of criminal justice. And the form in which this has taken in the U.S. is the institution of the drug court or drug treatment court. The drug courts are specialized courts very prevalent in the U.S., almost in every county in the U.S., whereby certain categories of drug offenders who are judged to be drug dependent, they're not all as it turns out, but are given the option of ostensibly medically sound court-supervised treatment as an alternative to imprisonment, or at least that's the theory. The judge comes off the bench, and the defense attorneys and prosecutors abandon their adversarial roles and become part of the team that works with the patient. I wouldn't burden you about talking about these institutions except that the U.S. has made this a center of its narco-foreign policy, and these courts now exist in many countries, having been heavily promoted, especially in Latin America. I don't have the time to say all of what makes me not regard this as an ideal public health intervention, but let's just tick off a few things. There are a huge number of evaluations that show that these courts lower recidivism. But as the U.S. Congress's own audit office has said, most of these evaluations don't have a decent control group. Often it seems that the jurisdictions have cherry-picked people to come into the drug courts who are more likely to graduate from the treatment, as it said. In addition, it's clear that they're not making much of a dent in the huge prison population in the United States, which was supposed to be the whole idea. Some of the judges, when somebody fails their treatment, that is, gets a dirty urine, as it said, in the random drug testing, they're thrown back into the adversarial system. By definition, they have a guilty plea on the record. That's the way the U.S. model works. And they wind up getting a longer prison sentence than if they had gone through the adversarial courts with a defense attorney to help them argue their case. So due process issues, everything all over the place. In addition, while we are in North America in the middle of a historically grave opioid overdose mortality problem right now, we have many, many drug courts where the judges, simply because of their own prejudices, will not allow opioid substitution treatment with methadone, buprenorphine as one of the choices for court-supervised treatment. This is mind-boggling to anyone in public health. One could go on. I think, to me, one of the things that's most troubling about these courts that rarely gets into the literature is that the patient stands in the middle of the court. The drug court people are there. Sometimes there are health people there, sometimes not. The attorneys are there. All kinds of other people are there. And whoever roams in off the street and is asked intimate medical details that should be a matter of confidentiality. We have standards on those kinds of things in medical ethics. In any case, suffice it to say that I think the preponderance of evidence about these institutions suggests that, at least in many jurisdictions, they serve more to widen the net and the strength of the criminal justice hold on drug use rather than embodying the commitment to treat drug use in the health sector. So the Lancet Commission that was mentioned before was charged partly with cataloging some of these public health unfriendly practices that are central tenets of an ostensible public health approach to drug control, but also to suggest what a real public health approach to drug control would look like. So let me run through those things quickly. I'll tell you what, I'm going to skip that. We kind of caught some flack on the Lancet Commission for suggesting that decriminalization of minor offenses was really needed if we were going to be serious about a public health control to drug use. And some people said that, well, you're really talking about depenalization or reducing incarceration for minor crimes, which doesn't necessarily mean decriminalization by law, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, you have to deal with this. This is a picture from the state of California, one way or the other. And the drug courts, again, claim to do be putting a dent in this kind of in the prison population. I don't think that's the evidence is there to say that that's happening. You see here the categories of offenses for which people are in federal prisons in the United States. The federal prison system is actually much smaller than the 50 state system, and the state system, the drug crimes, drug-related crimes, which is the long bar there, would not quite be so disproportionately long. But nonetheless, this is the heart of the issue. And what we have in public health, amazingly, is quite good evidence to suggest that the rate of incarceration in a country, and this is work that comes from Europe and Central, Eastern Europe and Central Asia, the rate of incarceration in a country for tuberculosis, with respect to tuberculosis, is an important determinant of the whole trajectory of a TB epidemic, even outside prison. We kind of tried to contribute something analogous to that great work by Stuckler and his colleagues in the Lancet report looking at hepatitis C, looking in a modeling way at scenarios of hyper-criminalization as in Thailand, less criminalization as in Scotland, and seeing the same kind of result, that the implications for infectious disease well outside the prison in the general population are profound. I guess skip that one and that one. So we have, in a way, a new politics of talking about drugs in the United States, not that new, and of course a lot of whatever progress we've made is going to be taken away by President Trump. As you see, the opioid overdose mortality crisis has hit the white population in a way that has actually led to an adjustment of life expectancy among white men, which is quite amazing, at a time when the bar there that says USH, the blue one, when Hispanics in the U.S. and obviously Western European populations are enjoying great reductions in mortality. This should mean that we should be running toward scaling up of methadone programs, for which there are waiting lists in many of our states and many of our big cities. We should be running toward being sure that everybody has access to clean injection equipment. We have plenty of studies like this one that shows that with a little bit of additional investment, which is the yellow there, we could get a huge bang for our buck in savings on having to deal with infectious disease consequences. But this doesn't really play very well politically. A rather cheeky article by Seth Kalickman, who is a professor at the University of Connecticut, came out in AIDS and Behavior, a pretty good journal, the other day that I wanted you to see. It says that our current Vice President Mike Pence should be put up with Putin and Becky as HIV-related criminals against humanity. And this is said because when Mike Pence was governor of Indiana, his last job, there was huge explosion of HIV and hepatitis C linked to opioid overdose, opioid injection in the rural parts of his state, where long since they had closed down Planned Parenthood clinics, which were the only ones doing HIV testing. They had disallowed any kind of needle exchange program. They had disallowed any kind of methadone. And the Centers for Disease Control had to go in and basically beat him up with the evidence. And even then, it was difficult for him to accept that those services could be politically palatable. We'll skip that. We have probably better public health evidence than almost for any intervention in the history of public health when it comes to supervised injection rooms or supervised consumption rooms, thanks largely again to our friends at the University of British Columbia. The site in Vancouver has been associated with lower needle sharing, lower HIV, lower HCV, lower crime in the neighborhood, better referral to people to all kinds of other services. And in this particular injection facility, and I think the same would be true in Switzerland and Germany, the other places where they exist, there have been more than 3,000 overdoses. People bring in their drugs, the same stuff that's in the drugs on the street is still there. There have been no deaths, there's been no brain damage, there have been no negative sequelae from these overdoses because the help is there. That has led to at least some consideration of what is a very misunderstood intervention in the American public by some mayors and local officials in a few places in the U.S. This happens to be about Ithaca, New York. But when the press talks about these things, it's again with words like haven for heroin addicts, or my favorite one in the press, opium dens. So we see that we have a long way to go, but these are definitely part of what you would call a health approach to drugs. Same with naloxone, which is the medicine that can reverse the consequences of overdose. It should be in the hands of everybody, not just first responders, but drug users themselves, their families, their friends, anyone who could be near anyone who's injecting opioids in particular. In New York, anyone can walk now into a pharmacy, anyone over the age of 18, and buy naloxone. Your insurance might not cover it. But, you know, this is part of what we think should be a public health approach to drugs, and it's impeded by overzealous control of naloxone, among other things. This has no recreational use, naloxone. There is no black market for naloxone, and yet still it's so over-controlled in so many places. We thought in the Lancet Commission to underscore that it's really a good idea if we're going to have a public health commitment to drug control to be sure that we can do research on the drugs that do have medical promise, the controlled substances, I should say, that do have medical promises. We are missing seriously out on medical uses of cannabis and a whole lot of other psychoactive substances. So we have some evidence from that childhood epilepsy that's very intransigent and not responsive to other treatments can be treated by cannabinoids, but we have very little research because the research is blocked. And now again, in the middle of this opioid overdose epidemic, we have the beginning of research that suggests that in the states where cannabis is more available, there's less use of prescription opioids and less overdose mortality. And yet the research that needs to be followed up there will not be funded by our federal government. So anyway, as we tried to show to conclude in the Lancet report that, you know, reformers who are looking ahead to this post-drug war era that John spoke about and want to think about humane and evidence-informed drug policy really have to know how to scratch the surface of these facile rhetorical commitments to public health approaches. Public health approaches, so-called, that cling to grossly harmful, knee-jerk incarceration for minor drug offenses, that refuse to offer adequate harm reduction, that subject people to treatment that is little different from torture, and give judges and security personnel the authority to make medical decisions, those are not public health approaches to drugs, and we need to be able to know that that's the case. Just a postscript, because I couldn't resist, since we're told now that we're in a neo-Nixonian era, though the incumbent Richard Nixon, compared to our current president, I think was a model of tolerance and self-restraint. But he is given credit for being the author of the war on drugs. It was only with the UN General Assembly special session last April that we had an amazing piece of research come out from Dan Baum, who put it in Harper's Magazine, an interview that he was able to unearth from John Ehrlichman, the main domestic policy advisor of Richard Nixon, who said that, in fact, this famous war on drugs was really not about drugs. It was about the fact that the White House needed to do something to deal with these upstart blacks who had just had their rights reinforced by sweeping civil rights legislation, and to deal with the anti-war activists. And if you could associate those two populations with drugs, you could criminalize them, you could arrest their leaders, you could raid their homes, and you could vilify them, as it says here, every night. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. We can't let it be the case that the real motivations for repressive drug policy are hidden behind rhetoric on public health or public security or anything else. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chetter. I'll take that as a cautionary corrective to any sort of misguided optimism we might have about a new era in post-drugs war policy. But anyway, thank you. That was fascinating. Dr. Scheiner, can I ask you to round up our presentations with your...
Hi, everybody. First of all, I'd like to say thanks to John for the opportunity to speak today. You've heard a lot about evidence and rationality. I'm interested in irrationality or apparent irrationality, and I'm interested in failure. I suppose the combination of irrationality and failure is why I study drug policy, I suppose. What I want to talk to you about today is one very specific attempted reform, which happened here in the UK, the reclassification of cannabis. Cannabis was reclassified within our legal system twice within a decade, and the second one reversed the first one. It's not a typo, it is a foiled reform rather than a failed reform. And what I mean by a foiled reform is a reform which was opposed, resisted, and subverted. So the broad outline of what happened. So cannabis was downgraded. So we have a legal classification system, a three-tiered legal classification system. Most harmful drugs placed in Class A, least harmful in Class C. So what we had was we had an initial reclassification of cannabis, which was downgraded from Class B to C as of January 2004. Now, this isn't akin to the more dramatic reforms that we've seen with decriminalisation and the introduction in some places of legal cannabis recreational markets. But nonetheless, within the context of the UK, this was a very significant reform. It was only the second time that a controlled substance had been downgraded since the introduction of the Misuse of Drugs Act in 1971. It was very significant because downgrading a substance to Class C, according to the legal provision at the time, meant it was no longer an arrestable offence. So the possession of a cannabis, according to this reform, would no longer be an arrestable offence. This led the Daily Mail to claim that it was tantamount to decriminalisation and prompted the resignation of the then drug czar, Keith Helliwell. So it wasn't a complete failure. Very quickly, cannabis was actually moved back from Class C to Class B with effect from January 2009. This prompted the dismissal of the then chair of the ACMD, David Nutt, amid claims that evidence was being ignored by government, that this was clearly a politically motivated reform. Now, this has received quite a lot of attention. A lot of people already know about this. I guess my point is, in a sense, this was pure symbolism, because the reform had already failed. The reform had already been subverted. Although the reclassification and the sacking of David Nutt were what grabbed the headlines, these were largely symbolic. The reform had already been resisted, had already been subverted. And what I'm going to suggest to you today is that there are four things that we need to explain. How did cannabis come to be classified in the first place? How was it that cannabis was downgraded from Class B to Class C? How was this apparent reform subverted? And why was classification reversed? And what are the lessons for drug reform more generally? And of these questions, I think the hardest one is the first one. How is it that cannabis was reclassified from Class B to Class C? This was largely a liberal reform. It was seen as being a liberal reform, which eased the law against cannabis. Now, this happened in the midst of a situation where no politician could afford to be seen as being soft on crime or weak on crime. It was de rigueur at the time to be as hard on crime as it was possible to be. And yet, in the midst of this, we get a relaxation of the drug law. So we need to go to some lengths, I think, to explain how that happened. You can see that I've got a bit carried away and confused with my metaphors. I started off with a U-turn, and then I ended up with a car crash. And I guess I'm going to say that if you do a careless U-turn, then it can end in a car crash. Sometimes. Right. So what are the origins of the reform? So I think the most important thing to say at the outset is that this reform originated outside of party politics. It originated outside of Westminster, outside of the main political parties, and it was really rooted in the work of the Independent Inquiry into the Misuse of Drugs Act, which was chaired by Ruth Runciman, who is a very astute, very formidable campaigner. Actually, she probably wouldn't like to be described as a campaigner, a policy operative, shall we say. And it involved medical professionals, drug treatment specialists, some police officers. And the conclusion of the inquiry was that demand will not be significantly reduced by the deterrent effect of the law. And it proposed the reclassification of a number of substances based on the harm index that you heard about earlier. So David Nutt, I think, was a member of the inquiry, and it proposed a series of reclassifications based on the idea that current classification was a misrepresentation of the harmfulness of substances. So it said that cannabis should be downgraded because to grade it as a Class B exaggerates its harm. A more realistic assessment of its harm is for it to be classified as a Class C substance. And it proposed this as a broader set of liberalising reform. So it supported the abolition of prison sentences for most possession offences, and it concluded that the cannabis laws causes more harm than it prevents. Now, initially, all of the inquiry's recommendations were rejected wholesale by the government in the run-up to the 2001 general election. But what happened after that quite quickly was we got an opening up of a window of opportunity, and a number of things came together which created an opportunity for a liberalising reform. So firstly, New Labour won the 2001 general election with a massive majority, so it could be less risk-averse than it was prior to the election. The independent inquiry report was warmly received by the media, including by the Daily Mail, and the Daily Mail is a really important barometer for what Middle England is thinking. So for politicians, it's a really important indicator of where public sentiment, or at least media sentiment, is at. So that was a very significant signal that even the Daily Mail was calling for a mature and serious national debate on the issue of cannabis. Some other things that were happening, which I'm sorry you can't see on the screen, were some shifts in the political landscape. So that we saw after the 2001 election, there was a leadership campaign in the Conservative Party. One of the key figures in that was Michael Portillo, who campaigned on the basis of a new social liberalism, which included a commitment to the decriminalisation of cannabis. His erstwhile colleague, Peter Lilly, wrote a pamphlet on legalisation of drugs at that time. And so what this signalled was actually an opening up politically of the issue, which made certain things possible which previously, I would suggest, hadn't been possible. Important point about the road to reform. So after the election, the new Home Secretary, David Blunkett, declared there is room for an adult intelligent debate. Sounds like we heard that somewhere else, so very much echoing what the Daily Mail was saying. And he went through a series of processes to essentially ask a number of professional bodies on their view of reclassification, and basically they all said, yeah, go ahead, it's a sensible move, cannabis should be reclassified. Reclassification came into play at the beginning of 2004. Interestingly, and try and hold on to this for what we're going to say later, although the independent inquiry said that the case for reform was largely based on the idea that cannabis is not sufficiently harmful to be a Class B substance, the way in which it was framed by the government or marketed by the government was very different. So it was consistently presented by government as a way of freeing up police time to focus on drugs that cause most harm. So an important shift in the discourse around the reform. There was a process of negotiation involving senior police officers. Significantly, the power for arrest was retained, but the assumption, according to ACPO, the Chief Police Officers Association, was that the assumption for a first offence should be against arrest. And this, although arrest was retained, that this was still potentially progressive because a cannabis warning, which was a newly introduced disposal, wouldn't involve a criminal record. So if you've got a cannabis warning for a first offence, it's an on-the-spot fine, you get issued with a warning, you don't get a criminal record. Okay? So still potentially a liberalising reform. Actually, what we saw was anything but a shift in resources away from cannabis, which is what people expected. What we saw was a massive, classic case of net widening. So what we saw was a huge increase in the number of out-of-court disposals for drug possession offences. That was overwhelmingly driven by the new cannabis warning. So what we see from 2005 is this huge increase in the number of official sanctions issued by police for cannabis possession offences. This went totally against what the independent inquiry was recommending, and indeed what the government was suggesting, which would this would see a shift in police resources away from cannabis to drugs that cause most crime. What we saw actually was the complete opposite of that. Now, this was clearly not a response to changes in drug use. So what we've got here is we've got two lines here. The top line is drug possession offences recorded by police, and the second line, the orange line, is levels of drug use as measured by a self-report survey. What you can see is we saw a massive increase in the number of drug offences recorded by police at a time where drug use itself remained constant and was on a slight downward trend. So what this increase in sanctions reflects is not an increase in patterns of use. It clearly reflects a change in police practice. And we see that very clearly if we look at stop and search. So we saw a massive increase in the numbers of stop searches conducted by police for drugs. We know that we don't know for a fact because police don't record what drugs they're searching for when they make the search. But if we look at the breakdown of drug possession offences recorded by police, we know that 2/3 of those offences are for cannabis possession. So based on these figures, in 2010-11, when there were over 1 million stop searches carried out by the police in England and Wales, around about 1/3 of those were for cannabis possession. So hadn't seen at all this deflection away of police resources away from cannabis possession. Actually, what we'd seen was a concentration of police efforts on cannabis possession. So how can we explain that? I think we can explain that in two ways. Firstly, police culture. So policing essentially for the police, I suppose, is seen as really being placing a priority on crime fighting and the maintenance of social order through assertions of moral authority. That's essentially what policing is about symbolically. So it's about this assertion of moral authority through order maintenance. Other clues are provided by ethnographic studies of police involved in drug policing. So Matthew Bacon found that most officers are wedded to the drug war mentality, and even if they have doubts and they're pessimistic about the effectiveness of their efforts, they stay motivated by operational successes on a case-by-case basis. Daniel Baer, who did his PhD here at LSE with me, found something similarly, where he said that confiscating drugs provided officers with a tangible outcome that eluded them in many other situations. So drugs, cannabis, is both symbolically hugely important for the way in which police imagine their job, and secondly, it's one of the ways in which they get a sense of achievement. So essentially what I would argue is that as an unwanted externally imposed reform, the reclassification of cannabis was adapted to reflect the priorities and practices of the police organisation. So the police were a key factor in subverting this reform. So that general resistance and opposition within the police organisation to this reform was reinforced and sharpened by the emergence of a target culture. So this massive increase in drug possession offences recorded by the police coincided with the introduction of public service agreement targets. So the Treasury set the Home Office a target for the number of offences which were brought to justice. The Home Office in turn passed those targets on to the police. So essentially what the police wanted and what the Home Office colluded with was a high clear-up rate. Drug possession offences are great from that point of view because the only time pretty much the police record a drug possession offence is when they find drugs. So your hit rate is about 97%. Essentially, the police don't record drug possession offences if they don't catch someone with drugs because they don't know about it. So what was crucial in this perspective, so essentially, so we said before that the cannabis warning doesn't count as an arrest, so cannabis possession remains an arrestable offence, but it doesn't count as a criminal record. What was crucial in this, and I don't think anybody realised this at the time, was it remained a sanction detection. So a sanction detection is the measure by which police effectiveness is measured. So a sanction detection is an offence which is cleared up by the police. So cannabis warnings provided a fast track to a sanction detection. Daniel Baer's work showed that police officers could issue a cannabis warning within about half an hour, compared to, say, the paperwork involved in a shoplifting offence, which would take 24 hours. So in a sense, police were being purely rational in their response to a perverse incentive structure. What the cannabis reform, the introduction of cannabis warnings, had done was inadvertently introduce a perverse incentive structure which rewarded officers for going after cannabis, which actually was the complete opposite of the intention of the reform. That said, so we can quite easily explain why the police responded in the way they did. There's a broader question of, well, why did politicians allow them to? And again, if you look at the literature, then there's a tendency, I think, to play up the irrationality of what happened, so that this crazy U-turn when drugs was reclassified twice within 10 years, and this whole process has been described as a debacle, a kerfuffle and a farce. But I would argue, and what I attempted to show, was that there is a logic to what happened. And the logic to what happened politically, I think, is reflected in David Garland's work around what he calls the structured ambivalence of state responses to crime. So essentially what Garland argued was that the last third of the 20th century saw a massive increase in crime in the US and most West European districts. What this highlighted was really the inability of the nation state to control crime within its sovereign borders. And the state responded with two strategies. One was the sovereign state strategy, essentially one of denial. No, we can still stop people committing crime. It doesn't matter what the figures say, we can still do it. The example he gives of this is the war on drugs, which essentially, he says, is an absolute form of denial with the state acting out in a very irrational way. The other kind of approach, the much quieter approach, is what he calls adaptive strategies. And this is where the state adapts to the reality that actually it can't control crime within its sovereign state borders. Reclassification of cannabis, the introduction of a cannabis warning scheme, is a classic example of an adaptive strategy. You recognise that actually you can't stop people taking cannabis. You protect the court from getting clogged up with cannabis offences because you simply don't think it's sufficiently important. There are far more important things for the court to be getting on with. And crucially, what Garland argues is that political actors and what he calls administrative actors relate to these things very differently. So for political actors, whose interests are very much shaped by the politics of re-election, are oriented very strongly towards sovereign state strategies. They don't want to admit weakness. They don't want to admit anything other than a tough-on-crime perspective. Administrative actors, so heads of social services, civil servants, these people are not governed by the politics of re-election. Their primary focus is on evidence and on what works. So they're much more likely to pay attention to evidence and to highlight carefully argued evidentiary cases. And I think essentially what you saw over cannabis was a clash between political actors and administrative actors. And there were good reasons for this. So the Labour Party, the Labour government, was paranoid about being portrayed as weak on crime. It had lost consecutive elections in the 1980s and 1990s. Being weak on crime was its Achilles heel. Tony Blair was deeply concerned with the Daily Mail as an indicator for what Middle England thought. His entire strategy was based on claiming Middle England. And what we saw was the U-turn was not purely a political U-turn. The U-turn was a U-turn of press coverage. So the same newspapers that had called for a mature debate about cannabis in 2000 and 2001, kind of embarrassing the Labour Party into the initial reclassification, in 2003 were saying this is a dreadful mistake, this absolutely shouldn't happen. Michael Howard, who'd been elected as leader of the Conservative Party, was saying that the future Conservative government would reverse this absurd and misconceived decision to downgrade cannabis even before it had come into place. So he was head of the party where Michael Portillo had been campaigning on the basis of the decriminalisation of cannabis. So essentially what I'm arguing is what we saw was the political landscape shifted. So that what we saw in 2001, 2002, when the Labour government made the initial decision, was a very brief window of opportunity. The decision to reclassify politically made sense then in a way that it absolutely didn't just 3 years later. So, in conclusion, what I really want to highlight is what I think the lessons are of this foiled reform. And I think there are a number of things. Firstly, I think it shows that reform is not simply a top-down process. We cannot think of drug reform as simply being determined by governments who then tell disinterested people to do what the government has decided because policy doesn't work like that. There are lots of people with interest. There are lots of people who will resist policies from a top-down position. It's also a process, not an event, that we need to be able to respond to unintended consequences. So in terms of cannabis reform, what that meant was we would need to go back and not make this a sanction detection. So actually, the decision to make this a sanction detection is the basis of the failure of this reform. Let's just withdraw it from being a sanction detection. Let's not have it being included in the way in which the effectiveness of the police are assessed. The other point, which I think is a really important one, in drug reform we get caught up in slogans, we get caught up in legalisation, decriminalisation. Actually what this says is the details really matter. I think when the decision was made for cannabis to be a sanction detection, I don't think anybody really understood the consequences of that. So what I think is that these details really matter. And also the final thing I'd like to say is we need to understand organisational dynamics better, and we really need to focus in detail on thinking of what are the threats to the reform we want and who are our allies? And we need to take seriously the politics of re-election because it's a crucial factor in the way any of this stuff is going to play out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Scheiner, and thank you all the panel for some very good presentations, a diverse and rich set. We've eaten up a lot of our time, but I do want to give you an opportunity to ask questions. So I think what I'll do is I'll take a group if there are multiple questions out there and then ask the panel to respond. Can I ask you to raise your hands if you've got a question, tell us who you are, what your affiliation is, and wait for the mic to arrive, which it will. Yes.
Thank you very much. The name's Ewan Grant. I'm now a business intelligence consultant, but many years ago I worked in the Customs and Excise Investigation Division when that was the lead agency for dealing with drugs trafficking. Obviously, it's all changed now. I've just seen in the last few days a BBC report which does rather illustrate much of the futility, and I think it's very much down to for you to listen to people like Dr. Collins and his experiences in Colombia. It's a classic example of how on earth did this take too long. My question is based on particularly the last two speakers, your comments. Is there any indication of a genuine coming together of social workers, healthcare professionals, and law enforcement, even if only partially, because the final comments about the culture in the police I certainly recognize. And secondly, in relation to the comments about the rise in middle-class opiate abuse in America, how well are vulnerable persons being identified? Because I think I'd be very interested to know what the profile of such persons is. And I suspect it ought not to be too difficult to get early warning signs of who such people are. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more? Yep.
Oh, yeah, the name is Luke, and I'm just a random person here. What I'm really interested about in calling it a public health crisis is what kind of people are we talking about? Are we talking about real drug addicts, occasional users, first-time users? And if there are significant differences within these groups, does a public health response require different approaches to these different user groups, I should say?
Thank you. Take one more there.
Hi, my name is Fergal. I'm also a student, I'm a student at LSE. I just wanted to know something about the dark net and how that's changing drugs and drug trade.
Sorry, can you say again?
The dark net, like ordering drugs online.
I think there was one down here.
Hi. Well, my name is Alberto. I'm from Mexico, so that's the thing that matters. I'm actually interested to see your thoughts about how likely do you think a policy change in Mexico is actually, like, is it actually a reality? Because I think the interests with drug cartels are actually inside the government, and it's going to be really difficult to see actually any change in policy in the upcoming years. And also, if you think that any change on the demand side of drugs could actually increment or increase the violence that we see from drug cartels, because the market would become smaller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Chetta, can I ask you to respond maybe to the first two questions, which were about more about public health policy and also addiction? Is there any indication of a coming together?
I got the questions. Yes, I think that what I would point to anyway, as successful drug policy reform would be in places where, in fact, the reform is characterized by the fact that health people and social sector people, education people, youth, sports, etc., are around the table with police doing policymaking together on a par with each other. That's not just a police and security issue. And that certainly is the case, for example, in Portugal, which is kind of the hackneyed example that everyone points to. But it's also the case in a number of other countries that have not gone to the extent of decriminalizing all minor drug offenses as in Portugal, but have actually tried to look at root causes of drug use. And I think this goes to the question about occasional users versus regular users versus actual addicts. The science of addiction in many countries, including my own, has not been protected from moral judgments, and it's a weak science as a result. But what we know about the science of addiction, I think, from the best scientists, is that this has to be a problem that's not just about how drug use lights up the brain or how, you know, the actual opiate receptors and from one individual to the next, but has to be about what's the situation that people are living in. What's striking to me about the opioid overdose issue in the U.S., everybody talks about it being linked to the financial crisis of 2007 through 2009 or so. But if you look at those figures, the increase actually started way before then, and that's because the Rust Belt, the formerly industrialized areas in the middle of the country, were in financial crisis before the whole country was in financial crisis, and that's where a lot of this happened. So, but we still somehow, you know, our policies, our research in the U.S. on this problem is all about brain scans and all this nonsense, instead of looking at people's situation. How is it that all these white people, intergenerationally, grandmothers and their grandchildren in rural areas are injecting together? I mean, these are amazing, amazing phenomena. What the hell's going on there? We need sociologists at the table with the clinicians, with the police, obviously. And I think that all of that has not well happened in the science of addiction and has not been translated in any sense into drug policy in a systematic way in many places. The beauty of the Portugal model, for instance, is that you voluntarily, if you want to, have a chance when you're caught with drugs, which are still illegal, but the actual offense is decriminalized, you have the chance to sit with social service providers who can talk to you and see if you have a real problem or not. Or if maybe your problem has actually nothing to do with drugs but has to do with employment or discrimination or some other sort of exclusion. It's a stunning way to think about drugs that we just don't see in too many places. The opiate addiction problem in the U.S. is complicated. Should we not be able to see early warning? Yes, we should be able to see early warning. If in fact we can get first of all, a consensus in this interdisciplinary, intersectoral way that we have to look at addiction in a much broader way than has been the case. But when you don't even have the services to deal with the people who are diagnosably dependent, when you have people having to wait, you know, the people who don't have anyone to help them to even know what's left of the weak welfare system and benefits system for poor people in the United States, all that stuff doesn't come together for people easily, especially in outside big cities. So I think it's a much broader problem that has to do with the deterioration of the social sector and of the welfare state in the United States, and that's not going to get any better before it gets worse.
Thank you. Michael, briefly, any lessons, any evidence from your reclassification car crash on cannabis?
I think there is one piece of kind of optimistic news in that story. So the literature will talk about how reform-resistant police occupational culture is and how the police are particularly resistant to reforms that come outside of the police organisation. I think that's all very true. But I think what the cannabis warning system also shows is that police officers are responsive to incentive structures. So I think what that tells us is if we can, we can use things like behavioural economics and nudge theory to try to change police behaviour, I think, but what that requires is that we use the right metrics. So I think what we really need to think about is what do we want officers to be doing, and let's measure that. So there is some moves, particularly in the US, where they're trying to move away from this kind of Hollywood action-oriented type of policing and really trying to incentivise officers to do much more progressive community work. So they're developing measures and indicators to try to measure that, which then form part of people's performance appraisal. So I think there is an optimistic story embedded within it. I think there is something, it does highlight some ways in which we can think about bringing about the kinds of changes that we want. But it involves a lot more detail than we're used to thinking about in relation to drug reform, I would suggest.
Thank you. John, do you want to just tackle a question on Mexico and maybe darknet?
Yeah, the darknet, very quickly, I think, is interesting because it gives us a quick glimpse of what a legalized market looks like in a lot of these substances, right? Like, you have quality control, you have product rating, you have people, basically, there's a flight towards quality. And there is a kind of self-regulation of the online market, and many describe it as harm reduction for the supply side. Now, I would caution that with a sense of it's a harm reduction for the supply side for certain types of consumers, usually white, wealthy consumers. So it's not really applicable across broad social segments, but it's an interesting example, and it is, I think, on balance, far better than having, you know, if you're talking about optimality here, it's far more better than having an open street market or dealing going on in an area. So it's an interesting one. It'll be interesting to see where it evolves. The case of Mexico, I think you could see some movement. They said that cannabis legalization in California would be a game changer for them. That has happened. I think you're going to see either by Supreme Court or by eventual legislation, Mexico is going to legalize cannabis, I think, within the next decade. I think that's pretty likely. They're talking a big game in terms of innovations more broadly on drug policy. What that looks like, I'm not sure, but I suspect that if relations with the Trump administration continue to deteriorate, cannabis could, not just cannabis, I think the war on drugs could become a leverage issue for Mexico and Central America, where they say, we're not going to continue to fight this on your behalf. Would a major reduction in demand impact the market? No. A massive reduction in demand, which is almost impossible to fathom. It's not possible to imagine what that would result in. Some of the evidence around declining cocaine consumption in the United States, which is shifting elsewhere, some of the suggestions is that helps explain the violence of the Mexico cartels because they're fighting over a smaller market. So it's not necessarily even reduced consumption would actually make the market less violent or less problematic.
Thank you. I'm sorry, we have to bring it to a close because we're going to get thrown out. But thank you very much, all of you, for your attention, but most particularly to the four panellists for giving us such a richness of perspective and insight into, obviously, a fascinating topic. So please will you join me in thanking them for their presence.